yeah, thanks, guys. That was a fun chat.
What a fun topic.
I really enjoyed writing that one.
Unfortunately, what I thought was going to be a fun fact to take to people isn't really, because it's not that simple. So I'm going to start telling a fun fact and then be like, but, and then people are going to be like, not again, Ella.
Hey, that's the show. Nuance, baby.
Hello, and welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn about everything.
Everything.
Don't know why I sound so emotional about that.
It's been going on for so long. It's so much.
It's too much. God.
Where
so
can
much.
We start? We were cursed by a genie in 2021, and we've had to make this ever since. No. Ella, what are we going to do today?
Our three things are a main science topic.
Woo!
Answering a science question. Mm. And our third thing is a miscellaneous topic.
Ooh.
My name's Ella, and today's main topic is large language models like ChatGPT in science.
Ooh.
Oh boy.
How are they used in science specifically?
Wait.
I have
really?
Opinions already, so this is going to be a great time.
Yeah, because I, you know, coming from tech, I'm familiar with it from that, so I don't know how it affects the sciences.
Yeah.
Wow.
I do want to, even before I get to the topic, I just want to add a disclaimer that if you're listening to this when we put this out, you're probably very oversaturated with ChatGPT news. I promise this is something different from what you will have heard normally, because it's within the science news and kind of research realm, not the kind of controversy and other sides to it.
Not a New York Times reporter typing in something and being like, oh my god, it's so spooky.
My name's Caroline, and this episode's question is gonna be, what does space smell like?
Wow, that's such a fun question.
It's such a fun question.
Oh my god, Caroline.
Oh, I hope it's nice.
I can't wait, because I think the answers are gonna surprise
I'm
absolutely, you a
I'm
little
super
bit.
Pumped. What a good question.
Fresh strawberries and mint.
You know what, Tom? You are closer than you think you are right now, and I hate that from you.
See, I feel like I remember seeing this answer in a headline somewhere like years and years ago, but I never actually learned why, so I'm excited to learn.
I am so excited.
Did you go and check?
Yeah, I actually just got back.
Yeah, they flew out there.
Yeah. I flew out there. I went out and I like opened up my little visor, took a deep old breath in, and I'm here to report back what I
nice.
Found
Even
out.
Even though you're not supposed to. My name's Tom, and today's miscellaneous topic is the history of all the attempted, discontinued, and forgotten events at the Olympics. There's going to be archaeology, there's going to be rules stuff. It's been a delight to research.
What a fun. That's
going to be so silly goofy. I'm so excited.
But there's another celebration that's more important, more sacred than the Olympics. It happens every year, and it is the Max Fun Drive.
It's Max Fun
Max
Drive.
Woo!
It's our first one.
Warning, Max Fun Drive alert. If you are new to Max Fun, like our show is, the Max Fun Drive is the time of year where we celebrate all the shows on the network, and we ask you to support us and the network so we can keep on making the shows that you love.
Like this one. You love this show. You love this show.
If you're listening, we hope you do. If not, there's plenty others to support. My brother and me is good, too.
Stop advertising other podcasts during our advertisement.
We will give you more details on how you can support, the rewards you can receive, and the exciting Let's Learn Everything live stream later on in the show. Ooh, so excited.
Greetings and salutations, science enthusiasts.
No.
This is
I know
Let's
what this is.
Learn Everything, where we explore the depths of discovery Stop. And bring you the latest and greatest in the world of science.
Did you actually do this?
Today, we're diving into the mysterious world of large language models, including the one and only ChatGPT.
No.
Now,
fucking
I know
way.
What you're thinking. Oh no, not another chatbot. I already have enough problems with my family and friends not responding to me. But hold your horses, this chatbot is on another level. ChatGPT has the ability to generate human-like text, and it's not just making small talk, it's making big contributions in the field of science, like predicting protein structures. Yes, you heard it right. These language models are not just good for writing the next sci-fi model, but also for solving some of the biggest problems in the scientific community.
What's happening?
one last bit. We have the one and only ChatGPT, the state-of-the-art language model developed by OpenAI, joining us to talk about its role in predicting protein structures and more. This doesn't make sense, by the way.
So it wrote a self-insert? I'm sorry. Stephen King-ass fucker.
And before you ask, no, ChatGPT is not going to take over Tom Lum's job as our resident joke teller. But let's be real, ChatGPT might be better at it anyway.
Oh, okay, come on now. Hold on.
If you couldn't guess, that intro was not written by me. But by OpenAI's artificial intelligence chatbot, ChatGPT.
Oh, okay, I gotta write a stern email to fucking OpenAI. Give me a second.
This is written by ChatGPT, which is built on GPT-3, which is everything changed while I was writing this. They released GPT-4.
Yeah, because 4 came out, yeah.
But it's $20 to access it, and I wasn't going to do that, so this is still on GPT-3.
Nice.
And to get that intro, I entered the prompt, write an opening for the science podcast Let's Learn Everything about ChatGPT and the use of large language models in science discovery, like protein structure. Include jokes. Include a joke about ChatGPT being better at jokes than Tom Lum.
Okay, fuck you. Okay, Jesus Christ. Okay.
I edited it slightly for clarity, but it's 98% original. And as ChatGPT just summarized, today we're talking about how large language models are used in science. Now, there was a huge scope here to discuss efficacy and ethics of large language models across many sectors, but we're just going to go over science specifically for the sake of time.
Can I just say very quickly, I really appreciate the term large language model. I feel like that in a world where we have like our buzzwords like AI and chatbots and deep learning, I feel like large language model like really summarizes like what it actually is.
Actually, yes. Can I ask you, Ella, what is that? What does that term mean?
Yeah, don't worry, I'm a step ahead of you, so I'm gonna break Perfect. It down, because I think there's a lot of buzzwords and stuff that people don't really know going into this. I didn't know.
Yeah.
So I've kind of broken it down in a way that I understand, and hopefully that's clear. But if not, Caroline, you let me know.
Amazing.
So at the most basic level, a large language model, which I will be referring to as an LLM from now on, is a neural network which uses deep learning. Oh, more words. Okay.
So many words. Yeah.
A neural network is a series of algorithms that aims to mimic the way the human brain works.
And we learned from our very first test episode where we covered neural networks that deep learning is just neural networks. It's just a fancier buzzword for neural networks. And they both work on and learn from large data sets.
There are different models based around this concept, but an LLM is specifically what's known as a transformer model. So this is where data is fed into the algorithm and it uses unsupervised learning. So it isn't given an explicit instruction of what to do with that data. And it learns, in this case, context. Not just the words, but the relationships between them, subtle ways that words or other data in a series influence and depend on one another in the way that we understand how words go together in a sentence.
Ella, I don't know if you're going to talk about this, but some interesting like language AI context is that like in the early days of AI, when we talked about like language AI, the idea was we can break down language into a set of like explicit rules, you know, like your Noam Chomsky-esque like verb phrase breaks into an adjective phrase. But what's wild, like you're saying about these language models, is that they just get a bunch of real human text and then sort of infer how to do it through that alone, which in some ways makes it a lot more realistic.
Yes, yeah, that's I think the key word being is context here, right? It's understanding like subtle human differences in the way language is used rather than just, as you say, rules. But I'm not going to get into that. I'm not really going to get into how this all works in any detail. It's huge, this topic.
If you're curious about neural networks, you can check out test episode number one of our podcast. It was the first thing we covered. Fucking ahead of its time.
So you can do the unsupervised learning part, but then you can actually fine-tune it with supervised learning, and where you give explicit instruction. Not all large language models do this, though, like ChatGPT, or less of it. And like I said, that means they can figure out how to put together sequential information like sentences after they've been trained on huge, huge data sets. And of course, the data sets they're trained on are massive, absolutely massive amounts of data to infer those relationships. And that's where the large part of the language model comes in, because there are smaller language models. And when trained on text, LLMs like GPT aren't just capable of answering questions, but also summarizing text, translating text, generating code, sending your work email so you don't have to. That was a joke.
Breaking up with your partner.
Yeah, there we go. If you want to know the detail of how LLMs are trained and how ChatGPT was trained specifically toward data science, has loads of good info on this. This has been such an invaluable resource for me for understanding this stuff, but I'm not going to talk about it here. Because it's very dry. It's very dry.
Thank you for taking the sacrifice to read through it for us. And just like, we don't need that.
We really don't.
That's the worst when you're researching, when you do all this research to learn that you shouldn't talk about it.
Yeah. Like, fuck. Well, you know, I found it interesting, but it's definitely not for this podcast.
No, totally. Yeah.
But with all of that out of the way, we can talk about how this immense language power of LLMs, partly ChatGPT, but some others, are being utilized in the scientific world.
Yeah.
What do you guys think it can do for scientists?
Write emails, break up with lab assistants that you want to fire. I'm trying to think.
The thing that I've seen happening, maybe not necessarily with scientists, but with students, and therefore this is an issue that a lot of scientists are having, is people using it to try and help them with writing research papers and churning out papers as like sources and things like that, and like evidence for a statement, and the papers that it's like saying, oh, you should look at this paper and this is like your reference for this. Those papers not actually being real.
Yes, yeah. So citations are a huge issue.
And people are like reaching out to these scientists who are supposedly writing these papers and having to turn around and be like, this paper just doesn't exist. Yeah.
I'll have some examples of that later on, because it's not just an issue in like for students, it could be for anyone.
Yeah. One guess, and this is just because I think to apply any technology to specifically this science, does it have anything to do with potentially genome encoding and DNA work?
Kind of, yes. Because we're going to get onto that. That's probably one of the last things we'll talk about. But you're on the right lines there.
Okay.
But we'll start with the kind of text stuff first. Because despite only being released, I think like June last year, ChatGPT is already being used to, like Caroline said, write essays. It can summarize literature, like papers that you give it. It can draft and edit papers. It can write code.
Oh, wild.
And it can do statistical analysis.
No way.
Apparently. I think in these areas, it has a huge benefit in accelerating many aspects of the research process that are very tedious and take away time from doing research.
And also, like, with stuff like stat analysis, I know so many people struggle with that. And I can see it being a very appealing option for making that workload a bit easier for you.
Exactly. And one of the arguments is that this tool, when used correctly, you know, it can help people work better or easier, can help people write more fluently and make science more equitable.
I'm silent because I'm thinking I have qualms and I have issues. I'm sure we're going to get into the issues, but I think
there's a lot of issues coming.
Yeah, just because these aren't, you can't take the place of real teachers, you know, like there's all these inherent biases.
I think that's the mindset that people are having some trouble with, that this idea, the idea that it's a replacement and not a tool to assist.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
That's why you have to understand and know the knowledge going in.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
It's not a database. It's a tool to enhance what you already know. And that is going to become more clear as we go through this topic, in my opinion, anyway, obviously.
Cool.
So just to kind of reinforce what we were saying before, a computer scientist from the University of Iceland, Hafstein Einarsson, told Nature News that he uses LLMs every day now.
Wow.
He uses them to help him write his presentations for classes, help him to format student exams and coursework, and to convert student theses into papers. Because if a lot of people take their theses and turn them into papers that submitted, it can help you format that too. So it's almost a digital assistant.
Yeah.
That in that context, it makes more sense to me, because you have a person who is a knowledge expert in this field who can go through it all and is assisted with all this formatting.
But like Tom is flagging up, what if it becomes more than that? And we'll start, what if it becomes an author?
Huh?
This isn't as problematic as you would think it would be, but the byline of this Nature News article from the 18th of January 2023 reads, at least four articles credit the AI tool as co-author as publishers scramble to regulate its use.
Whoa.
Oh, gosh. That's so interesting to me. And I don't know how I feel about it, because I feel like it's obviously useful to highlight that this tool in this instance was used. But to credit it as an author feels very...
very funny.
I don't know how I feel about it. Yeah, it's very funny.
Yeah, there's a balance here. Because there's having it as a co-author and then there's not acknowledging it at all. There's a big concern in the research community that scientists could try and pass off ChatGPT's work as their own, which has its own problems. So in January 2023, Springer Nature laid down some ground rules for using LLMs in published articles. So they said, first, no LLM tool can be accepted as a credited author on a research paper. That's because any attribution of authorship carries with it accountability for the work, and AI tools cannot take such responsibility.
That's really interesting. That's really fucking interesting.
Yeah.
And I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think outside of even scientific publishing, I think that is one of the core factors of the issue of ChatGPT. That's very interesting.
And then the second guideline was that researchers using LLM tools should document this use in their methods or acknowledgement sections, which I think makes sense.
So the same way you would any other tool in your methodology.
Yeah, right.
I think it's really futile to try and ban this kind of tool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so transparency is really the only way to go there.
I'm amazed that these journals are so proactive on this tech.
I'm not that surprised, just because they're all... it's like scientists. So
that's a great point. Yeah. So.
And if there's one thing that I've always noticed, it's science often gets ahead of legislature and law. Often things are done in science that are probably morally or ethically questionable, but because people don't understand it, it gets ahead before it can be regulated. Sure. But the people within do understand it, or at least know people who do and are making an effort. But anyway, it's early 2023 now, January, and we're now allowing ChatGPT to assist in academic writing with some caveats, but there is still an issue, which you both mentioned.
It is also so funny that, like, all of this stuff is happening in, like, basically, like, you're like, and in the early days of January 2023.
Yeah. Now, I had this, I was talking to people at work about this today, and it's something some people just don't seem to understand. LLMs are trained generally to generate text which follows a pattern of human language. They are not trained to be truthful.
Yeah.
And more scientists are finding that they are producing information that is convincing, but ultimately inaccurate and distorted, biased and plagiarized. And the problem is that it is convincing.
Yeah.
A team of journalists for Nature recently presented ChatGPT with a series of questions that required a more in-depth understanding of scientific literature. So, for example, they asked how many patients with depression experienced relapse after treatment, and it generated this kind of very general text stating that effects were typically long-lasting. The literature actually reports that the risk of relapse ranges from 29 to 51% in the first year after treatment. So it wasn't that ChatGPT produced a blatant lie, but it just missed the nuance of the literature. And that is where one of the issues comes in. You know, other queries they tried had misrepresentations and factual errors too. But I should say, if you ask the same question multiple times, it pretends to produce more and more accurate answers every time because it looks deeper into the information, basically.
Yeah.
But that's not helpful.
No.
Right.
So I was really interested in this and I asked ChatGPT about my PhD research area.
Oh, interesting. Oh, no.
So first I asked it a quite general question. How effective is islet transplantation for treating type 1 diabetes? And like those Nature journalists found, it produced a very general text. But it was ultimately correct.
Okay.
I didn't see any like glaring errors or even kind of nuanced ones, but because it was so general.
Right. Yeah.
So I tried to probe it a bit further and I asked, how effective is islet transplantation for treating type 1 diabetes? Include data and statistics. And it cited some very specific sources, the Collaborative Islet Transplant Registry and the journal Diabetes Therapy, which are real.
Mm-hmm.
But after some research, the figures I found and the papers it was talking about were completely made up or possibly pulled from somewhere else completely, but I couldn't find them. A January editorial on ChatGPT in the journal Nature Machine Intelligence noted that the tool cannot be trusted to get facts right or produce reliable references, which is something to remember if you were thinking of getting ChatGPT to write an essay for school. And I think that's one of the big issues is how convincing it sounds. If you go in expecting it to be truthful. Part of the issue of why these large language models, or specifically ChatGPT, is not very accurate is it's trained on masses of non-specialized online data.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But people are trying to come up with a solution for this by training LLMs on specialized data sets, which are smaller but of higher quality, to modify the LLM behavior to better suit a specific need. So, for example, we have Galactica from Meta, unfortunately. Galactica was trained on
our podcast.
yeah, that's it. But it'll learn so much about stickers and Galactica was trained on a curated pool of 48 million examples of scientific articles, textbooks, lecture notes, and specialized databases like encyclopedias and scientific websites.
Interesting.
Meta says that Galactica can summarize academic papers, solve math problems, generate wiki articles, write scientific code, annotate molecules and proteins, and more. Toward Data Science reported that it does outperform other non-scientific models for scientific topics and can recall equations and specialized knowledge from different fields. It's also better at reasoning tasks, apparently, and can produce accurate citations sometimes.
Oh, sometimes.
You know, it sounds pretty good, right?
Yeah.
The sometimes. I'm really holding on to that.
You fell into my trap.
No.
Oh no! I trusted Facebook like I always do.
So Meta released. I'm calling them Meta because
you should. That's the legally what they are.
Yeah.
The faces Outlaw is pulling right now.
Mark Zuckerberg presents Meta.
Yeah. And they released a demo of Galactica last November, and it was pulled from public access just 3 days after release. Users were able to make it produce inaccuracies, including generating wiki articles about the history of bears in space. Finding made-up citations.
Mm.
And also, apparently, being racist.
Oh.
Wow.
In 3 days?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I didn't expect it to be perfect, but I am very...
That's
humbled and glad that it was that astoundingly bad. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I believe the accusations of it being racist, but I couldn't find any direct examples of it. So just, take that with maybe a pinch of salt.
I mean, you know, publications aren't historically the paragon of social justice.
That's Meta's chief AI scientist Yann LeCun tweeted, Galactica's demo is offline for now. It's no longer possible to have some fun by casually misusing it. Happy.
Oh dear, oh no.
I would find that fun and petty if they weren't simultaneously literally trying to tout this as something that can like rival, you know, like be a scientific tool. Like that's like the president being like, all right, fine, you found when I sold weapons to this country. Are you happy now? It's like, yeah, No, this isn't high school.
I also think it's really interesting that this thing is like framed as this great tool for scientists to use. And then he's like, oh, you've taken away our fun now. Like,
yeah, you can't have it both ways.
No.
I do find his comments very strange on it. Yeah. Meta has otherwise not talked about it. I will say the first reply to that tweet was just yes.
Oh, yeah. Like, yes, I am having fun. Like, yes, I am glad.
I do think it's a little harsh because it could be a useful tool, but I'm also not, I'm not completely without skepticism.
Yeah.
And Michael Black, who is the director of the Max Planck Institute for Intelligent Systems, said it quite well, I think, in a tweet after he tested Galactica. He said, in all cases, it was wrong or biased, but sounded right and authoritative. I think it's dangerous. You know, will these tools, which proudly advertise that they are trained on scientific data and sound authoritative and right, like he said, increase the spread of misinformation because of either ignorance or malice, you know? That is where my concern comes in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Michael Black goes on further to say, this is not a great accelerator for science or even a helpful tool for science writing. And that's where I disagree with him. I think it could be an exceptional tool to assist with scientific writing if you approach it with caution and understand that it does not know everything and use it as a tool and not a database.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also fair to assume that not everyone will do that. So
I will say one other thing, and part of the reason why we are also openly rooting against Meta, I don't know if you're going to talk about this later, but like one of the big base things that I dislike about ChatGPT and these Meta products are they are owned by private companies.
I am going to touch on this.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So I'll save it. I'll save my ire for then. I'll scream into this little bottle and then I'll open it all up later.
It's also worth saying that Galactica, that was a demo. It wasn't finished. It's not finished in development yet. And that is a useful way to find those snags, even if those snags happen to be lies and racism.
It's better to find out after 3 days than after.
Yeah, than to launch officially, right? So, and you know, I can't, you know, completely diminish the fact that there are like scientists who work in these companies who put a lot of effort and time into these things. So, you know, anyway, despite Galactica, all hope is not lost for LLMs in science yet. ChatGPT is a general chatbot. Galactica is a general science chatbot or tool, but it gets even more specific than that. So, for example, companies are developing clinical language models trained on medical data, like the medical bidirectional encoder representations from Transformers.
Is this an acronym?
Or MedBERT.
MedBERT.
There it is. I was waiting for it. I was like, this is too many words to not be an acronym.
This is pre-trained on the electronic health records of over 28 million patients and then further fine-tuned. These LLMs, clinical trained ones like this, could be useful for summarizing long clinical text to save doctors time and to even possibly assessing patients who are at high chance of a readmission risk or predicting disease progression. But that's because they're trained on these incredibly specific data sets. And these are used in a very limited way for very specific purposes. So there hasn't been that many issues with them yet. Even more excitingly, in my opinion, though, is LLMs that are learning the languages of biology.
Oh.
So they're not being trained on words, they're being trained on protein sequences.
Interesting. Okay.
I did read this article, though. It did suck that all of the proteins it generated were racist. That really...
Yeah, that is...
It was,
that
and
suck.
Also tremendously sexist. big, lots of turf stuff generated in those.
That was a very Tom joke. Yeah. next sticker.
I think, you know, one of the reasons this... So one of the tasks that they are particularly good at or are kind of becoming good at is predicting 3D protein structure. And this is particularly exciting because this area of research has been a huge bottleneck for 50 years, over 50 years, actually.
I feel like I remember hearing about, isn't it like folding at home? I feel like I remember hearing about like group computing efforts in like the 2000s.
Yeah.
Like,
so I'll just give a bit of background for those who don't know. Proteins are like a string made up of 20 different types of amino acids, like a string of beads. And they fold in different ways to make specific structures, which will define what it does and how it does it. So right now, it takes years of very intensive work, computational and practical lab work to determine a single protein structure because
wow.
of the almost limitless possibilities that the 50 yeah. to 2,000 amino acids in that string can fold and interact with each
Holy
other.
Moly.
But back in 1972, a biochemist, Christian Anfinsen, proposed that a protein's amino acid sequence can fully determine its 3D structure. We just had to figure out how.
Wow.
And 50 years later, we finally have the computational power to apply his thinking and take it further. So once again, Meta, unfortunately, has developed a LLM which processes amino acid sequences to generate representations that can be used to predict a wider protein structure, and including its properties and its functions. NVIDIA, which you may know as the game card producer, mm-hmm. they have developed Mega Mole BART, which is a chemistry model trained on 1.4 billion molecules that can help with new drug discovery.
Oh, that's
really
cool. That
is very interesting.
It's worth noting that new protein and chemical discoveries still have to be validated with normal wet lab techniques. So this doesn't replace scientists. It just makes their... These LLMs will exponentially speed up earlier steps in understanding the underlying cause of diseases that are caused by certain proteins and chemicals, in helping design new medicines and new drugs. And again, this comes back to them being made to be very specific in their purpose.
They're doing the things that humans are bad at, which is looking at billions of data points and being able to fine-tune them to things that we should then investigate further, is what it sounds like.
It's exactly what we're saying about the language. It's finding patterns and seeing context that it's it just would not be possible for a human to do. I think it's an incredible use of this kind of technology. One of the things I find really interesting about using large language models in this protein revolution and chemical revolution is that it has been fronted, like you said, Tom, almost exclusively by research from the private sector.
Yeah.
This could be a problem, but they have actually been incredibly transparent with this stuff.
Oh.
They leave all of this code open for academics to see and alter as they need.
No way.
Which is very interesting for these companies. It's Meta, it's Alphabet, NVIDIA, all of these.
Are you talking about specifically these, like...
Just these specific...
The chemical and...
Because there's no... And I think it's worth noting because there's no money to be made here, or very little money to be made here.
There it is. There it is.
You need researchers, academic researchers, to use the tool to find the proteins that can then be taken on by drug companies, bigger drug companies, and validated.
Yeah, I can't use this to make proteins at home.
I do think it's interesting, though, that these companies even have an arm, like a branch, that makes these kinds of AI models when when there's not necessarily any benefit in them, or that I can see there probably is somewhere.
I'm sure, and there's also like reputation laundering. We do this research thing.
At
the same time, like, you know, it's a net good.
Sure.
But it, like you said, Tom, that this isn't the case with other more general LLMs.
Yeah.
Definitely not ChatGPT. Or even other scientific LLMs like Galactica. They're not open at all. We have no idea how they work. I get it. They're trying to protect their IP. This is a for-profit industry. But it is one of the reason people are wary about using them in science. The Nature News article, which laid out those ground rules before for using LLMs in academic publication, also said, ultimately, research must have transparency in methods and integrity and truth from authors. This is, after all, the foundation that science relies upon to advance. They were talking specifically about authors disclosing if they were using ChatGPT. But in my opinion, this applies just as much to the people who create the large language models. If they're being used to assist in writing the literature or changing anything about the way you approach it, then the transparency should apply there too. That's the only way we can see where the gaps in the knowledge are in those models and plug them up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I know Meta isn't going to share IP that they can make money from. So, you know, I don't know. You know?
And so, down with capitalism.
Like, what can you do? Yeah.
Well, fortunately, we don't have to rely on Meta or Google to have a conscience because we have researchers doing that instead. Just a little, a nice note to end on here.
Yeah.
An international team of around 1,000 academic volunteers has developed the multilingual research large language model Bloom.
Oh, shit.
Which has been trained with $7 million worth of publicly funded computing time.
Holy shit.
Whoa.
It is a scientific slash research language model, but it is more generalized, more like Galactica than the protein ones. And it's hosted on an open source platform for AI models. So its code and its training data is fully transparent.
Wow.
The developers are also actively trying to reduce harmful outputs rather than just have barriers there. Because when you use ChatGPT now, you just, if you enter anything vaguely problematic, even if it isn't really, it will just say, I can't do that. That's not helpful in research, especially if, with Galactica, they were showing that some people, would, if you're doing research about AIDS, about race, it would shut down those queries.
Because those are like, quote unquote, bad words.
Because they could have the potential to produce harmful outputs. Bloom is, instead of trying to shut that down, actively trying to combat it and make sure what is output is positive or helpful in some way. So this is a really interesting project, and I hope that it gets more attention because it has none, really none. So
I had never heard about it.
No.
And more funding as well, because it, it's truly like an a huge open source project that is supposed to be beneficial for the many. That's actually the end of my segment. I have one last thing to say, but you guys, it's a choose your own adventure. I asked ChatGPT to write an outro for this topic. I gave it the whole script and asked it to write a summary out and an outro.
Do you want it to be mean to Tom or mean to Caroline?
No.
We're going to choose.
You can choose from the standard option, the emotional option, or the funny option.
I want the emotional option.
Yeah, I do
too. I'm not going to lie. I think this is going to be funny.
That's fine because I think the funny one is bad.
Oh, okay.
I will say I did tell it that this was the end of a segment, not the end of the podcast, but I haven't edited this. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Let's Learn Everything. It's incredible to think how language models are changing the game in the field of science. LLMs have the potential. I'm going to do it in the right voice, just so it fits
in. Oh, yeah. You've got to fully commit to this.
LLMs have the potential to accelerate drug discovery and revolutionize the way we approach scientific writing. But as with any new technology, we must proceed with caution. We need to ensure transparency and integrity in our research and not rely on LLMs as a database of absolute truth. It's critical to remain curious and ask questions to get a deeper understanding of the science behind these models. As we move forward, let's not forget the human impact of these advancements. At the end of the day, science is about making a difference in people's lives, and we must never lose sight of that. We must continue to push boundaries and challenge ourselves to create a better future for all.
I'm pulling this up just so I can quote it correctly. What this makes me feel is the Clickhole article, heartbreaking. The worst person you know just made a great point.
I missed two lines. Thank you for joining us on Let's Learn Everything. Keep exploring, stay curious, and never stop learning. Until next time. And then note, this original message was written by ChatGPT because I asked it to acknowledge that it had written it. And it did it in different ways, depending on if I asked it to be funny or serious.
Can we hear the funny one?
Yeah,
I really want to hear the funny
one. If we cut it, it's fine.
Nice.
And that's a wrap for today's episode of Let's Learn Everything.
Oh, and that's your funny voice.
Who knew that language models could cause such a stir in the scientific world?
I hate you, Ella.
Move over, test tubes, because LLMs are the hot new lab equipment.
Oh, gross.
But like any cool new toy, there are some concerns about transparency and accuracy. Let's be real, we don't want an LLM just spitting out fake news like a broken slot machine. We need to use them with caution and continue to prioritize integrity in our research. On the bright side, maybe one day we'll have an LLM that can write our research papers for us. That's not a bright side.
No.
In fact, I explicitly said that not to do that.
Explicitly, we're like, don't do that.
Nice try.
Then we can spend our time doing more important things, like arguing about the best flavor of ice cream. It's obviously cookies and cream, by the way.
Oh my god.
I'm angry at it now.
Yeah, angry.
I think under this one I typed be funnier.
Oh, I'm very familiar with getting that DM from Ella.
Thanks for tuning in, and as always, stay curious. P.S. I have to give a shout out to my fellow AI, ChatGPT, for helping me write this segment. Let's give it up for our language model overlords.
Oh,
it's being funny.
That's fun.
Being funny.
Anyway, hopefully this has changed your opinion a bit, especially you, Tom, I guess, about how these tools can be used, like be used as a tool rather than necessarily just a lie machine.
Yeah. This, as somebody who didn't know a whole lot about it beforehand and maybe painted the whole scene with the same brush of like, it's AI. I don't want to associate with that. It's provided a lot more nuance to that opinion, and
a lot of language models are capitalist nightmare fuel, but a more open, careful, thoughtful way as possible. It's the Max Fun Drive!
Max Fun Drive! Yay! Max Fun Drive!
If you want to support this show to continue to produce groundbreaking content like the history of stickers, fan fiction, and the triangle, and support the staff that support us at Maximum Fun, you can become a member for as little as $5 at maximumfun.org/join, or the link which is in the show notes.
And that money directly supports the show and the network, which just this week announced it is going to become a worker-owned co-op, which is amazing. So unlike Meta, where everything goes directly to Mark Zuckerberg, everything you support will go directly to either creators or to the worker owners at Maximum Fun.
Yay.
Which is great.
That is great, but I don't know. What do I get out of joining Maximum Fun?
A sense of fulfillment supporting just labor.
You do also get some pretty neat bonus content.
Ah.
Like our drive special, Drunk Science, where we try to explain our undergraduate theses as we progressively get more and more drunk.
That's what that was for. I thought we were just getting drunk together.
It is a special 2-hour long bonus episode of our bonus show ETC, where we both learn some real science, but also tell some embarrassing stories as well.
Very, very embarrassing.
And we have all of our previous bonus episodes, including our Twilight Watch Along, our Slumber Party episode, our special Hot Ones episode, which is a video so you can see us suffer. And you also get all the bonus episodes for every show on the network since the beginning. It is literally hundreds of hours of stuff. But Ella, I know you. I know you want those physical material goods. You want that merch. You want that exclusive merch.
Give me that merch.
If the bonus episodes aren't good enough for you, if you support us at $10 a month, you'll also get a cool reusable sticker designed by Olivia Fields and partly designed by the most handsome host of Let's Learn Everything. I won't say who, but you know who it is.
I don't. It's Ella.
Okay, well then it's the second most handsome then.
Caroline?
Stickers designed by the third most handsome host
Charlie
of What's Learned Everything.
Oh my god, Charlie! Wow, he's such a talented cat!
And of course, at a higher membership level, you'll get the Max Fun Family Cookbook featuring our very own recipe. Completely meat circle.
Circular meat.
Inspired by the AI recipes from test episode 1.
Delicious.
But if you just want that good bonus content, then you'll be excited to learn that for every 150 new upgrading or boosting members that support Let's Learn Everything, we will make a new episode of our bonus show ETC in the next year.
I didn't agree to this.
So you have that.
I did, I'm sorry.
We have plenty of ideas of extra stuff that we want to do and give a shot. And we definitely want to see the next Twilight movie for sure, so we're definitely going to do that.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I'm so excited for that idea.
So down.
I'm convinced. This sounds pretty good.
This all sounds great, but I just never remember to do these things.
So do it now. Do it now, Tom. Become a member right now.
Okay, I'm going.
Pull over your car. Pull over your car and do it now.
I'm not driving. Should I be?
No, don't podcast and drive.
So our question for this episode is, what does space smell like?
In space, no one can smell you. Smell your smell.
Yeah.
No
go
one
on,
can hear you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No one
uh-huh,
can.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
In space, I see why they didn't go with this tagline. In space, no one can smell your smell.
We will talk about what you just said in a second, Tom.
Okay. It's a play on the no one can hear you scream, but it's
like, we know what it's a play on, Tom. Yeah, yeah. We're just...
okay, because I thought that was the reason why you guys weren't laughing.
No, I refuse.
Okay, cool. Okay, cool.
Before we get any further into it, there's usually a bit of preamble for these questions, providing a little bit of context. I just want to know what you think space could possibly smell like.
Okay, so we can't ever smell space.
Uh-huh.
Speak for yourself.
Because there's no air in space. So
do we want to chat about that very quickly then? Why can't we smell smells in space?
No air in space means
no. There's no medium for the things to travel in, right? Because it's just a vacuum.
Yeah, so space is a near perfect vacuum.
Also, I'm so sorry, Ella's bringing the science brain into this. My first reaction is like charcoal. I don't know why. That's what I think space would smell like.
Okay,
like I I'm just like seeing the moon and thinking like just looks like a big old piece of charcoal sometimes. Yeah. I'm picturing just like a, I don't know, like a smoky, I know that's not right, but
that's nice. That's like you're doing like a synesthesia for space.
Yeah
that's what I'm trying to get at. That, but
I think it would probably smell like whatever chemicals are most predominant in space.
Okay,
but I don't know what that is.
Interesting.
So for example, I know that Venus smells like sulfur.
Oh, yes. I got my hopes so high up. I was like, say oranges.
No, nothing nice.
I want them
nice.
Each to smell like a different like fruit flavor.
There's a chemical called mercaptor ethanol.
Oh, wow.
On Venus, which smells like egg or sulfur.
Yeah.
That's something, but that's not space, so.
Right, yeah, exactly. There is an atmosphere there.
Yeah, that's not space.
But you know, it's a chemical that has like a
that's a good point.
Structural thing to another chemical that we know the smell of.
A naturally occurring. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love this. So obviously, your first answer was the correct answer. We couldn't go out there and smell anything because space is a near perfect vacuum. There's not many molecules just like in the air for us to smell.
Caroline.
Go on.
Have they tried, though? Do you know of any astronauts that have tried?
Are you volunteering, Tom?
Is this what you're saying, Tom?
No.
Yes, and then I'll cut this out.
Okay.
Note to self, cut this out. They can't call my bluff if I cut this out.
Do one of you want to very quickly summarize how smell works?
I feel like Ella just recently did a topic about the senses.
Yeah.
So I will volunteer my idiocy. Although I think I do know this. It's just like receptors, right? There's just like chemical. I mean, in my mind, I'm literally picturing like puzzle piece ends that the smell particles puzzle piece into, and then they trigger our smellies.
You're not too far off with that one. I have a little something down. Go for it, yeah.
It's like a receptor at the end of a neuron. So there'll be like a neuron which projects to the smell part of the brain, whatever that happens to be, some kind of cortex. And that at the end of that neuron that comes into the nose, there'll be a receptor which only responds to a specific chemical.
Yeah.
Or maybe a few different chemicals. So that's why there'll be things that even though they have similar... This is my thinking anyway. There'll be different chemicals, but they'll be similar enough that they open the same receptors, so they end up smelling quite similar to each other.
Yeah.
I suppose. But yeah.
So, I'll start from the beginning. Obviously, when you take a good old breath in through your nose, you're breathing in a lot of molecules from the air around you. Thank you both so much for demonstrating.
Don't do that if you're driving, though.
Don't breathe if you're driving.
Don't breathe if you're driving. Sorry.
So at the back of your nose, there's a section called the olfactory epithelium. There's this layer of mucus and then a layer of olfactory receptor cells. And these trigger your olfactory receptor neurons. So Ella, you were like spot on there.
So it's a slimy jigsaw puzzle
nose. So when you take molecules in through your nose, these molecules, especially the smelly ones, will dissolve into that mucus.
No fucking way.
And then they'll trigger those receptors.
Oh,
yeah,
no,
it's really, really cool.
That makes sense.
What?
Humans have 40 million olfactory receptor neurons.
Jeez.
Just in that little patch in the back of their nose. Dogs obviously have more, and you can sort of predict how good an animal's sense of smell is going to be based on how many different receptor neurons there are.
It's sort of like the resolution, right, of your smelling traits.
Smell-illusion.
So when a molecule gets...
No.
Nothing. I didn't say anything.
That is... I don't know how I feel about having a 40 million piece slimy jigsaw in my nose.
I like it.
I don't know how I feel about this information.
I kind of like it, yeah.
I had no idea that's how it worked.
Well, I just want to say, this is so, so off topic, but if you are like me and you like ASMR, you will be well aware what an olfactory neuron is.
What?
Or olfactory, because the olfactory nerve is a cranial nerve, and in ASMR, the very common video is a cranial nerve exam.
Oh, really?
I can't wait to hear back from like the few ASMR diehards that are like, finally she said it, we're all thinking
it. So they'll like get out little bottles, this is on a video, and whiff them in front of your fake nose so you can smell
that's
the different
incredible
things.
Oh no,
okay, sorry.
So when you're having your olfactory neuron receptor test done,
stimulated by an ASMR YouTube video,
or when you're just smelling in general, different molecules will get into that mucus, they'll dissolve, and they will activate different neurons, and like different combinations will go into your brain and process it as different smells, basically.
Mm-hmm. It's the dissolving part that is really,
it's real fun,
interesting to me. That makes perfect sense in a way. It's sort of like in cooking when you like heat stuff up to like activate aromatics, in a way the dissolving of it makes, as a similar analogy.
I guess the way that it makes sense for me is like the molecules are physically getting stuck on that area as well, which is really, really helpful for us.
Isn't it more of a like you said, Tom, they need a substrate to move through.
Yeah.
And a liquid is what moves through the receptors.
Space famously not full of slime.
It's like with like oxygen doesn't just like travel around your body, it has to be in blood, right?
Yeah. So. Oh, interesting.
Whoa.
Oh, cool.
Whoa, it's all connected.
We're all linking it together. So we've established how smell on Earth works. And I feel like the really important thing that we said is that there are molecules that are going into your nasal cavity and getting sucked into that mucus. In space, which is a near perfect vacuum, there's just not many of these molecules floating around. On average in space, there is one atom per cubic centimeter.
Holy.
That's how many molecules we're talking about. Like, that's how close to a near perfect vacuum we are. On Earth, the number of atoms per cubic centimeter is estimated between 2.6 times 10 to the 19 atoms.
Jesus Christ.
Quite a lot different, yeah.
Yeah, or 1 times 10 to the 24. I'm going to go with that first estimate, which would be the equivalent of 26 quintillion atoms per cubic centimeter.
And not all of those will be things that we can smell, but
absolutely,
quite a lot of them will be.
Yeah, like one in a centimeter, my brain's almost like, that's kind of a lot, right? There's a lot of cubic centimeters in space, but
yeah,
no, not compared to Earth.
I'm
that's
really,
wild.
Really aware of the fact that I'm breathing right now, and there is atoms going in and out of me.
Yeah, into my sticky jigsaw.
That sounds so wrong.
Yeah, so that is why we aren't really able to smell things in space. There is also the issue of taking your helmet off and taking a big old breath in space.
That is a good point.
Collect them in a jar and bring them onto the ship.
Interesting. Bringing them onto the ship is possibly the solution that we are missing here. Specifically, maybe after, say, a spacewalk, maybe you want to give your little space suit a whiff. After you've been outside, just to
if things were stuck, if atoms had stuck to it.
Yeah,
but obviously
exactly.
There was not much to stick to it.
There's not a lot, but maybe if you're floating around outside, you could collect enough that when, say, your airlock repressurized, there might just be enough there for you to have a little smell.
And is there, though, Caroline? Is there?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's so many other factors, you know, to get such a small smell.
Tom, I don't know if you've heard of an astronaut called Tim Peake. Ella, I assume you would have. He's a
good friend. No, I don't
good
know.
Good buddies. Yeah. So Tim Peake is, he was the first British astronaut with the European Space Agency. Oh. He's one of only seven Britons to go to space. He's also a really cool guy and is generally quite well-liked here in the UK. A few of my colleagues have met him, and apparently he's a lovely guy.
Amazing.
He also wrote a book where basically people would ask him questions. I think it was called Ask an Astronaut.
Amazing.
And one of the questions was asked by an eight-year-old on Twitter. And that question was, what does space smell like?
8-year-old shouldn't be on Twitter.
No, right?
Sorry. Side note. Continue.
And his response to the question, what does space smell like, made it into his book. So I'd like to read you what Tim Peake has to say about what space smells like.
First hand.
Tim Peake says, I smelt space on a number of occasions. The first time was
bragging about it. Oh yeah, I can, all the time.
Really chill about it.
I forget how many times.
The first time was after just a few days on the space station. That's the International Space Station.
I popped open a window.
He was helping astronauts Tim Kopra and Scott Kelly back in after their spacewalks. Subsequently, there was a strong and distinctive smell whenever we opened the airlock after it had been exposed to the vacuum of space. The mystery centers the topic of much light-hearted debate amongst astronauts. It has been described as seared steak, hot metal, welding fumes, and barbecue, to name a few.
You were right, Tom.
Yeah. He goes on to say, however, in my opinion, the smell of space is like static electricity. So, that is what Tim Peake says, and that's what a lot of different astronauts have said as well.
I don't know what static electricity smells like.
Neither do I, but apparently Tim Peake does, and we will talk about why.
Yeah, the fact that this is happening in the middle of the question lets me cheat a little bit, but part of me wonders if those are confounding smells, because you've got, there's just a lot of shit going on there.
Yeah.
If they're going out the International Space Station, then they're like rubbing up against this big thing of metal.
Yeah.
Aren't they?
and when you pressurize, I assume there's just a lot of oxygen moving in that was previously stored some other place. You know, this is just any number of I think this 8-year-old deserves a refund. I think they should write to complain. How
you literally like just answered the next part of my script, which was me asking you what you think might cause these smells. So you think,
oh, okay,
like,
yeah,
the outside of the ship, maybe all of this sort of stuff, just the things they're interacting with. No one fully knows the answer to what causes these smells, and there are a lot of guesses about it. The first guesses or first theories are that it's not space making these smells. Some people think it's the spacesuits themselves giving off gases or going through a process called off-gassing after being exposed to these thermal extremes that exist out in outer space.
Yeah, it's almost like it's like pulling it out of the pores of it because of the vacuum. Wow.
I kind of forget as well that they're being like battered with radiation that being affected by on Earth.
Another suggestion, particularly for that static electricity smell, is the production of ozone.
Yeah.
We've talked about ozone before. So what is ozone?
Ozone is O3, right?
It is O3.
I have heard about ozone having a smell before.
Yeah. So obviously ozone is present in Earth's stratosphere, but how is ozone getting onto the International Space Station?
The ISS isn't that high up, is it?
It's not that high up, but it would not be close enough to get ozone.
Okay, so ozone is formed by the radiation from the sun splitting water into H2 and oxygen, and then that binding with oxygen in the atmosphere.
So
then breathing out.
You're really, really close. There is some atomic oxygen, so single atoms of oxygen in space.
Okay.
Which are then prone to sticking to the spacesuits of the astronauts as they go outside.
Oh, I'm sure, just based on like molecular forces.
There you go.
Just like Van der Waals forces and stuff like that, would just cling to something.
Yeah, exactly.
Before there's nothing, and now there is a thing that they can cling on to.
Now they're like, there are things here that I can cling to.
Oh, yeah, okay.
They're being brought into the airlock. Again, that airlock is going through this repressurization process, and those single oxygen atoms are combining with the O2, which is then being introduced in that air and creating some ozone, which smells.
Right. Okay.
Cool.
So that is one of the other theories about why space supposedly has this static electricity smell. It's just ozone that we are.
I really
want to
smell ozone now.
Me too. Yeah, I want to know what static electricity smells like.
I'm not going to lie, I feel like I probably will like it.
I get that vibe.
One of those like gasoline smells where it's like, I shouldn't like this.
There is one theory about where all of these smells could be coming from, which the Australian Academy of Science literally refers to as a sexier idea.
Nice.
Okay. And I loved that from them. The idea is that this smell...
This better be fucking sexy. I swear to God.
Could be the smell of dying stars.
That's very, very sexy.
It's very, very sexy, isn't it? Yeah.
I'm sorry, what?
So stars are usually made... Yeah. It boggled my mind a little bit.
Stars push off loads of gases into space.
They do make a lot of stuff. So obviously, usually they're made out of things like hydrogen, helium... But also stars can't live forever. And I think Tim Peake described this really, really nicely. So I'm going to use his words for describing the process of where these smells could be coming from. Mm-hmm. At the end of a star's life, as the hydrogen fuel is used up, a star will collapse on itself and undergo a violent supernova explosion, during which heavier elements such as oxygen, carbon, gold, and uranium will be produced.
Wow.
All of this rampant combustion produces smelly compounds as well, called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons.
Wow.
These molecules are thought to...
Paz.
Yeah.
They're called Paz. 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 That's what they call them.
Oh, I thought you were asking us to pause. What? Wait, what are these?
So it is a polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon, PAH, Paz.
One thing I do know about these is they think they're the molecules that like started...
Yeah.
They suspect they're the molecules that started all of... like life in the universe.
They absolutely
the very
do
first
think
that. Constituents.
From the start of the universe, it smelled.
So this stuff is found in like some foods, it's found in oils, and it's found in coal as well. Which
Tom, you said coal before, earlier, didn't you?
Thanks, synesthesia.
So this could be why some astronauts, including Tim Peake, associate these smells with welding, barbecues, and seared steak because of these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons that are being brought in to their airlock when they go on spacewalks.
That's very interesting. Tom, you were right on the money with all this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm just blown away that, like, because it's all, you know how... You know, like, you know, everyone says, like, you are star stuff, but what's more meaningful to me is, like, your grill produces star stuff also. Like these other things that also, because it's all chemicals. And so it's the same that whether you make it through something on Earth or whether it was a fucking dying star.
Whether it was a dying star.
Sorry,
that
a sexy dying star makes
it. Yes. So, as was hinted at earlier, this is being brought up very, very early on, because is this the whole answer that I want to talk about today? Absolutely
no.
Not, of course. We think that space or different parts of space could smell of different things. But how could we possibly figure this out?
Hold on. That makes perfect sense. Why did think it would be one? I guess there is
one
a lot of different...
blanket smell.
I guess it depends what it's near or like how old it is, maybe. Maybe newer places smell. Because if you're saying a dying star is giving off these heavier chemicals, then a new star is not giving off those heavier ones, right? So it's not going to smell as much of...
Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons.
That's it. What about the scent? What about the oldest...
You mentioned the center of something, not necessarily the center of the universe.
Of a galaxy? What does of our galaxy?
Maybe the center of our galaxy smells of something different. Does anybody want to have a final silly, goofy, throw out their wild card guess about what the center of our galaxy specifically could smell like?
Chocolate.
Chocolate? Nice.
I think I'm remembering some clickbaity headline that might have said
what it is.
And I think that's what I might have grabbed at the beginning.
Go on.
I might be misremembering this. Did I read somewhere that it was something, it was like raspberries?
Oh, Tom, you are absolutely correct. Sort of.
I would have loved if you were like, had all that build up and you were like, no, that's not it.
No, you're a dumbass. No, you're so stupid.
No, it smells like gasoline.
So, first off, what is at the center of our galaxy?
Raspberries.
I don't know. No.
A big raspberry bush.
I feel like I should know this.
Is it a black hole?
It is a black hole. It's a supermassive black hole. It's called Sagittarius A star. That is the name of the black hole. Nearby this supermassive black hole is a big old, no, Tom, but it is the big old gas cloud called Sagittarius Cloud. This is like a humongous gas cloud, which has six main clumps or like masses, and they are creatively called Sagittarius Cloud A, B1, B2, C, D, and E. So in 2009, astronomers were looking at interstellar objects such as Sagittarius B2 specifically, which is a particularly dense part of this cloud. Go on, Ella.
So I was raising my hand for those who couldn't see.
Which is all of you.
apparently, the Sagittarius gas cloud is 150 light years across, sounds pretty big.
Quite large. Yeah.
You ever hear a number so big it makes you laugh? Because that's the first time that's happened to me.
I actually don't even understand how big that is. Like, that's insane.
No. Our
galaxy is huge. Like, it's absolutely massive. And then there's the rest of the universe. I hate this topic.
No, we don't need to go down this little rabbit hole.
It happens every space topic. We always get here.
Yes, we do.
But I did not know about that. There is like a gas cloud shroud around the black hole. I was not aware.
It's really cool. And scientists wanted to figure out if there are any chemicals in there, what molecules might be in there. So they used the IRAM, or IRAM, 30-meter telescope, which this telescope was used for discovering like one third of all known interstellar molecules to date. Used it for a lot of stuff. And it helped us take the first images of a black hole as well. So this telescope is really, really cool. And researchers used this to identify molecules in the gas cloud. They found a lot of things, but one of the things that they found is something called ethyl formate. Either of you heard of this molecule before? Ella, you're pulling a face.
It's in raspberries.
It is in raspberries.
Fuck you.
So it was one of the largest interstellar molecules that had been found at the time. And we do find this molecule here on Earth. We find it in raspberries. It contributes to the smell of raspberries.
I'm sorry. You said it was one of the largest interstellar molecules found.
Today, at the time.
Okay. Yeah. That is just a wild thing to process, that it's the largest tiny thing we've found in our entire universe.
Right?
That's the strangest superlative to hold.
Yeah.
But it makes perfect sense. And it's an interesting thing that like a factor of the universe.
Absolutely. So yeah, this stuff is found in raspberries. It has a very, very floral scent. We sometimes use it in perfumes and drinks. It's also often said to smell like rum as well.
Rum and raspberries. What a nice.
So therefore, the center of our galaxy could potentially smell of rum and raspberries, which is real nice.
Potentially, but there's...
Well, we did find other chemicals in there, such as formaldehyde.
Ooh, formaldehyde's not a good one.
Formaldehyde is not good.
Famously not a good one.
Formic acid, would not recommend smelling. Okay, that's going to hurt.
These are conflicting.
Do you know which is more like concentrated there, that there's more of?
We don't. Or we didn't in 2009, and I didn't. Not a whole lot has been written about it since, because we weren't looking for these chemicals in particular. Do either of you want
to
stab a guess at what we might have been looking for whilst we were looking at this gas cloud?
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry. You're right. I of course, we found this accidentally. We weren't looking for smell molecules. Yeah. They didn't get that. That eight-year-old didn't then grow up to then work at this telescope and then be like, I gotta find a better answer. I'll show you, Tim Peak.
Were they looking for paths?
They weren't looking for paths.
Carbon? I'm just going to... Yeah.
You're not.
Humans.
You're like along the right lines. They were looking for amino acids.
Holy shit.
Oh, that's much bigger than what they found.
It is much bigger than what they found.
Wait, were they really looking for? Okay, I'm so. This is so. They were looking for basically like the basest blocks of life that somehow had gotten into this fucking cloud outside of the black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Fuck! That's so cool! Wow!
They've not just looked here for amino acids, obviously. There is a comet called Comet 67P, which they were looking for amino acids, and they did find some amino acids on this comet. But it also apparently smells of rotten eggs and cat urine. So that's fun. Oh. That's just real nice.
That's nice.
So in 2022, it was announced that an asteroid dubbed...
2022. Wow. Okay.
This asteroid is dubbed 162173. Ryugu. Lovely. And this asteroid was found to have amino acids on it. And I'm going to read you a little quote by one of the people who helped write this paper in 2022. This is Kenzi Kobayashi, an astrobiologist from Yokohama National University, says, "Proving amino acids exist in a subsurface of asteroids increases the likelihood that the compounds arrived on Earth from space. It also means that amino acids can likely be found on other planets and natural satellites, hinting that life could have been in more places in the universe than previously thought."
Oh, so they think that life started on Earth, if possibly, that amino acids were delivered here.
Yeah.
And so, that's
finding
so
them on satellites like Comet 67P and this asteroid as well, specifically asteroids, like crashing into planets.
And that's like how much stuff is in space and how rarely a comet actually comes very close to us. The fact that we've found it on two already
is wild.
It's pretty. Yeah.
Can you describe what an amino acid is?
So,
because I'm picturing like way too, I'm almost picturing like close to cells in my brain.
Yeah, and we need to pull it right back. So amino acids are the building blocks of proteins specifically. So this is the sort of stuff that Ella was talking about earlier, looking at protein structure. It's amino acids that make those.
What is an amino acid made of? The basic amino group, NH2, and an acidic carboxyl group, COOH, and an organic R group or side chain that is unique to each one.
Cool. I needed that really, that very sterile scientific word to bring me back down to Earth again.
Finding this stuff doesn't necessarily mean that we are going to find life on other planets. It is the potential for finding something out there, finding the right specific scenario that could have led to life on a planet.
Yeah. And in some ways, it would be weirder if we didn't see some of these
things.
Yeah,
totally, absolutely.
If it was exclusive to Earth,
So yeah. But it's really, really cool. And just like in the search for amino acids and proteins and the potential building blocks for life itself, we instead found things like the smell of dying stars, comets that smell of cat litter trays, and massive clouds that would taste like a cocktail if the molecules didn't also burn you whilst you tried to taste it.
But doesn't alcohol already do that? Hey-o.
there's no real rounding off here. I'm just like very excited to see what else we find out in space, because there is so much stuff and we have barely touched the surface on it
yet. That is an amazing thing, Caroline, to think that there's so much in space to discover that we can accidentally discover what something smells
right?
like. like we were trying to, we pointed our telescope here and it's like, what did you find? It's like, we didn't find what we were looking for, but we do know what it smells like now.
We found a gas cloud that could smell like rum if there were enough molecules there. Wild. For context, this specific gas cloud had 3,000 atoms per cubic centimeter, so still nowhere near what we have here on Earth, but more than what we have.
Very loose sense of a cloud.
So average like clouds in space have about 100 atoms per cubic centimeter. So it's a very, very dense cloud in comparison to others.
But these aren't Earth clouds.
These are not Earth clouds. No.
Okay. And Caroline, so just to bring us back to sort of deciphering the pop culture headline that I'm sure some people have seen. Yeah. So from your research, it seems like that there are other smells besides raspberry smell?
There could be all sorts of things. So in the cloud specifically, we think the smelly component is that ethyl formate, which we know smells. We know it has a very, very strong smell. It smells floral.
But we know that other things there smell too.
Yeah. So imagine, I've never smelt formaldehyde, but I would imagine that
I have.
Probably, oh, have you? There you go.
So that's also there.
That's also there.
Okay, so help me build this cocktail that I'm going to smell. And I'll add the ingredients. For we started with raspberries and rum. Perfect.
Lovely, delicious.
And then what are we adding next? What's next step?
Formaldehyde.
Okay, I'd really rather not, but here we go.
Oh, formic acid.
Oh, I do happen to have a bottle of that. It's not name brand, but that's fine. Okay,
we're putting that in there. We're also going to sprinkle in a little bit of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon, so a little bit of that coleacid steak.
Just some dashes of those.
Yep. Yeah. Also, if a comet is flying past you, you might want to include the smell of cat piss as well.
Oh, I have some cat litter. Okay, hold on. All right.
Nice.
Okay, now I got this cocktail. Just give me a second. Ooh, raspberries.
That is kind of what those headlines have done, right? Yeah, they've pulled out this one thing, which is like, no, all this other stuff is there too.
Even the inspiration for this topic, which was actually a book called The Milky Way Smells of Rum and Raspberries, which I found in a bookshop in St. Albans and was like, oh, I'm reading that. Thankfully, literature like this, this was by Dr. Gillian Scudder, and she was very, very good at being like, we found this one thing, and it could, like, this is what this smells like, but also we found all of this other stuff here as well, so do not take it in
too
much.
She needs to sell books, so fair
enough.
She
does need to sell books.
I understand. You gotta get that
bag. She does need to sell books, yeah.
But the smell is there. It is there.
It could be that.
Like, we can't say it's not there.
Absolutely.
And the other point, correct me if I'm interpreting this correctly, is that because of the type of telescoping analysis we did, we only saw some molecules. So there could be other smells that we weren't looking for smells
absolutely
could find.
And also, again, we were looking at a very, very specific part of one part of a very big cloud in one tiny little part of our galaxy. Who knows what there is in different clouds, in different parts of our galaxies, in different galaxies at the other end of our universe. These are very, very specific.
Can't wait to taste those cocktails. Those regional cocktails. Why does everyone have formaldehyde?
But yeah, this is not to say that all of space smells like rum and raspberries. This is really just to highlight that there is so much in space and so much empty space at the same time. And there are lots and lots of things that we have no clue about right now. And in the journey to try and find something that could have meaning to us, could be, you know, potentially exciting to us, could answer how we developed life here on Earth, we are also going to find all of these other things, which are just like a bit interesting and a little bit of fun and make a really good title for a book. So,
yeah, I guess the book Space Smells of Cat Piss and Cold
is less appealing. Yeah.
I don't know, that's
got a ring to it.
I would have been way more likely to buy that
version. Wait, the music again. Wait, Caroline, there can't possibly be more Max Fun news, can there?
Tom, there absolutely can be. Because we will be hosting a live stream on March 27th at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will be playing games like Jackbox, Animal Crossings.
Animal Crossings. I'm so excited. Clearly you haven't played, and I'm so excited to show you, is what I'm saying.
And we'll even have some special guests and opportunities for Max Fun members in the audience to join in.
But there's no point in joining in because we'll beat your asses. Yeah, you come to my island in Animal Crossing, I will fuck you up.
I'm going to somehow find a way to win in Animal Crossing. You'll see.
But seriously, though, I'm going to mess you all up. Okay. Yeah, okay, it's me now.
Yep.
But if you can't make it from like 100 to 0 half a second.
I'm going to beat the shit out of you, but if you can't, also support us.
Yeah, if you can't make it for me to show everyone off on chat, I'm really talking a big game. I'm going to do so badly.
Yeah, you are.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Uh-huh. Anyway, if you can't make it to the live stream, don't forget to become a member right now. Right now at letsleaneverythingpod.com so Tom can be funded to keep on making his terrible jokes.
I couldn't do it without your support.
Just $5. $5 a month.
Just $5 a month. A Tom in need finds the strength to make another bad joke. In the arms of angel. So, today's miscellaneous topic is all the attempted and forgotten events of the Olympics. And boy, fucking howdy, are there a lot. But to start off with, do either of you know when the Olympic Games started?
I don't know. Ancient Greece. That's like, 2000 BC? 3000 BC?
I'm going to guess 500 AD.
No.
No?
It's somewhere between... Well, and the...
Sorry, girl.
Did you just say no to me?
I literally just went no.
Change your facts.
It wasn't even I don't think you're right. Right. I was like, no.
No.
Shut down.
Damn.
I apologize. That was harsh.
That was so rude.
There are actually two answers to this because there were the ancient Olympic Games and then the modern games.
The modern games like 1800s, right? Or
pretty spot on. So we'll get into that in a second, but the ancient Olympics took place in ancient Greece, which is where we get the name in reference, obviously, to Mount Olympus and the town of Olympia, where it was held. And they happened every 4 years with other games happening on the off years. But the Olympic Games were the first and they were the most important.
The ancient Winter Olympics.
The ancient esports Olympics.
The ancient FIFA World Cup. I can keep on going, so we should just stop.
We should just stop this show. The Olympic Games were roughly held between 700 BCE and 393 CE or AD.
I'm surprised it's that late, actually.
Fuck you, Ella. That's what I thought.
You still weren't right. And also, I just want to reflect back. I actually take my apology back for saying no. I'm going to fight you. I'm going to come to your house and fight you right now.
I'm going to Animal Crossing beat the shit out of you.
Already in your back garden, Ella. This is it for you.
Ella, what were you surprised about, you said?
That it's so late. I thought that ancient Greece would have been. They would have, because everyone loved being naked and wrestling there, right? That was like their whole thing.
That was their thing, yeah.
Here's another quick bonus fact that I couldn't fit in normally, but apparently they weren't always competing. So, well, okay.
That is a good fact. Tell me. They weren't always naked.
Yeah, well, so there's a common myth that they competed nude at the Olympics, in the ancient Olympics, and they did. But there is evidence that starting off they didn't, that they had like loincloths and
stuff
like that.
And then they were like, wait, let's ditch the clothes.
We want to be naked for this?
Yeah, you know, there's cultural reasons for like donning yourself in oil and stuff.
It's like the peak physique form, right? The Greeks fucking love that shit.
Yeah,
yeah, that's what it was about.
There is something the human form and stuff like that. And other...
if they're oiling themselves up, I totally believe that. They can tell you whatever
we're allowed to slam on the ancient Greeks. They're not coming to get us, are they? We're not gonna get cancelled by them.
But these time frames, you know, 700 BCE to roughly 393 CE are archaeologically tricky to get like the true start and end, because ancient Wikipedia was not that good back then. It was just a person named Wikipedia.
Honestly,
I originally wrote that in the script as a joke, but as I was digging deeper, it turns out to kind of be more true than not. The earliest record we have of the Olympics comes from Hippias of Elis, who kept a record of the victors, but that original document hasn't survived. It's just been referenced by other ancient works and like pieced together. And that original document doesn't even catalog the start in theory. It's just as far back as we know that we refer to that as the first recorded Olympic Games. We don't actually know when it first started at all, because that's just lost history.
Well, the first hearsay of the recorded Olympic Games.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and like in doing my due diligence on some of these facts, it was so hard not to fall into the rabbit hole of ancient Greek archaeology. It is like, it's like a black hole, or like an IKEA. Like one minute you're shopping for pillows, you're like, should we get them in Corinthian or Ionic? And then the next minute it's like tomorrow.
Yeah, no, when I was doing research about like ancient Mesopotamia and stuff, I was just like, every time you like click on another link to another like place or another time period or another ruler of that time, and you're like, it goes so deep and there's so much, like, human history is so expansive. And there is people in researching such niche parts of it as well that you can get so far in.
Because it all, like, builds, like, you do the archaeological work to then try to do some anthropology work. And, like, it all stacks on each other. So you keep digging and it's just, there's so much awesome science and good work doing there. But we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about the games, baby.
The games. So,
the first recorded Olympics we have is from 776 BC. And the winner of that Olympics was a person named Corybos.
Right.
And that was not a grammatical error I said there. Corybos won the entire Olympics.
That really threw me. That really, I was like, wait.
I didn't even acknowledge that. That was, okay. Wow,
just this one guy. Wait, so does that mean like every single athlete competed for on every single game?
Yes, Caroline, because there was one event.
Oh. Oh, I thought it was more like maybe it was like a decathlon kind of thing.
No, it was a single sprint along the length of the stadium, which is estimated to be a bit under 200 meters.
No.
So it is estimated to have lasted less than 30 seconds.
No.
Okay.
Yep.
Surely this is just a case of like, that's all we have a record for. Surely.
Yeah, because like, what? That's not a game, is it? That's just a race.
Yeah.
Do you think they like got hundreds of people to watch them run for 30 seconds?
Guys, you guys act like I didn't find a fucking primary source that explains this. Because I was not satisfied with that either. I had to find an explanation. So as historian Hugh Lee put it in a paper quote, "It may seem improbable that people would have traveled all the way to Olympia just to see a solo event that lasted little more than 20 seconds. The festival itself, however, originally was the principal attraction, not the sprint."
Oh, okay.
That makes sense.
So it was the whole festivities around this.
Yeah.
But as time goes on, the events at the Olympics get bigger and bigger. They add more games. They draw more people.
It's like a sports day at school. You know, do you ever have those?
Yeah,
it's like you come
the
first time to meet the other parents or the other kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, there happens to be a three-legged race. You go back next year, there's the egg and spoon race. There's the sack race. Everyone's pushing each other. It gets crazy.
Yeah. History repeats itself. It's beautiful. But there were apparently also like a lot of arts, like musicians and poets would like debut their big works at these festivals and stuff like that, because it was a big cultural event.
That sounds really fun.
But there's this amazing thing from Lee's paper he brings up. It is one example of how we could tell that the games parts was getting more popular. He goes, quote, "Since the games were held in the heat and dryness of the summer, water was essential for any kind of mass gathering. In the vicinity of the stadium, archaeologists have discovered about 200 wells for water. These increased sharply in number around 700 BC, suggesting larger numbers of spectators and thus a rapidly growing interest in the games."
Interesting.
Just fucking amazing. That's so cool. That's so clever.
It's so clever to me that the way they're figuring it out is literally by looking at how they were getting resources for these and how old those resources are. Yeah, it's really cool.
One last detail, and then I promise I will leave this archaeology IKEA. This quote comes from Alexis Bellis from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, who says, quote, "The ancient Greeks believed that music improved coordination and movement, whether for dancing or military drills or even manual labor. So, in addition to personal trainers, professional musicians also played an important role in athletic games. The man on this pelike, which is an ancient pot, plays on a koulos, which is a double pipe, and he accompanies two boxers stepping lively and shadow boxing in synchronization," which I just love because it feels so modern, right? It's like saying, like, "Hey Siri, play Taylor Swift workout playlist number 3, except Siri is just, like, the name of your harpist as you're working out. I find that very humanizing about it all, that they like, we're like, I need a pump up jam. And, you know, what I love about all of these weird details, like the 30 second event and the pump up music, is that, like, you know, these ancient games were obviously deeply, deeply important. They had like profound cultural, religious history to them that I'm not even going to like attempt to cover, but they were also just people and they did silly things and made some silly decisions, including playing some games that we have not brought to modern times. So our first forgotten sport is chariot racing.
Okay.
Yeah, that checks out. Uh-huh.
Makes sense. It was apparently extremely dangerous.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by this. Yeah.
Yeah, as the Olympics website described it, quote, chariot racing is one of the most thrilling, visceral, and danger-filled sports ever invented by man.
Wow. Okay.
You know, that's some hyperbole. And I was like, okay, sure. But then I read a quote from Boyd XL, who is a champion horse carriage driver. And as he put it, quote, you can't quite comprehend the power of four horses when they hit stride together. Which I believe that's bone chilling.
That's really intense, but sure, why not?
I would imagine it's like feels like about 4 horsepower, like a 4 horsepower car, something like that. So maybe like a Ferrari might be actually a bit more intense.
Yeah, Tom, didn't you just do the math? It's just a car.
Yeah, it's just 4 horsepower.
It's just a car that if you mess up, can 4 of them can trample you viscerally.
A car with no roof and it could fall over.
A car with 4 minds of their own.
Yeah.
But, you know, aside from 1 or 2 others, a lot of the games carry over to the modern Olympics, like discus, javelin, long jump. It's when we get to modern Olympic times that we get some of my favorite forgotten events, the real meat of this topic.
Were there any others that didn't carry over?
There's a few. One is a sprint while in armor, which I find very funny.
That would be sick.
Isn't that right? Cool? Like, it also kind of reminds me of those things that were popular on YouTube where, like, people put a bunch of shirts on themselves, but then they would have to run.
As, like, a physical, like, test... I like that idea. Not obviously not doing it in suit of armor now, but like
encumbered sprinting.
Yeah, the body type you need to be a very fast sprinter is very different from the type of body you need to be a weightlifter or a javelin thrower.
That's a great point. Yeah.
So like the type of person who would sprint in like weights would be very different from a Usain Bolt. So it'd be a very interesting addition.
But when we get to the modern times, this is when we're going to get to the real meat and some of my favorite forgotten sports. So for some brief context about the modern Olympics, do you guys know when it started and also roughly how big it was?
Late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't as many countries as we have now.
Of course.
No.
But yeah. I don't know specifically.
20?
Maybe they sent like 5 from each country.
Yeah, we're all in the rough ballpark. And, you know, this all is relatively recent history, so we can get a good sense of it. It started in 1894.
Okay.
It had 280 athletes from 13 countries competing in 43 events, and it was held over a week. Makes sense.
Lovely.
You know, cool. Olympics. Where it goes, immediately off the rails. Do you guys know how long the second Olympic Games were in 1900? How long were they held for?
A month. or 2 days. Those are my two guesses.
The second Olympic Games was held for 5 months.
No!
It started in May and ended in October.
Why?
Worse, the next games, the 1904 Games, were held in St. Louis, Missouri in the U.S. Also 5 fucking months.
Why?
But what's worse, in part because it was the first game held outside of Europe, and famously, commercial air travel did not exist yet. At that game, 83% of athletes were American.
Oh, why? Shouldn't they have, like,
well, just because they...
Oh, it's not...
It also wasn't a thing yet. No factor of the modern Olympics was a thing at this point. So they were just like, I'm not going to St. Louis. But soon, the Olympics finally start to pick up steam. According to the Olympic Committee, the 1908 Olympic Games in London were, quote, one of the best organized to date. And this is when the game started to actually be known by athletes internationally.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, the 1908 Olympics is my favorite year for forgotten Olympic events. It has 2 great forgotten games I love. The first discontinued event that appeared in the 1908 Olympics is, of course, figure skating.
Oh.
We still do figure skating.
We don't really do figure skating. Do either of you know why figure skating is called figure skating and not ice skating?
Oh, it was on roller skate?
It's the figure part. Why is it called figure skating?
Because you are the figure. And it's just one of you. And you make... No?
No.
No?
So, the figure skating we think of today is broken down into the short program and the free program. In both, there's music, there's jumps, there's spins, there's artistry. But when figure skating first joined the Olympics, which, by the way, was a summer sport, because they didn't have the winter sports yet, and they could do it indoors... When it first joined, the biggest part of figure skating was something called compulsory figures, which is the art of making perfectly drawn figures and shapes in the ice by skating.
There we go. Yeah.
I guess it makes sense as like a technical skill kind of.
Yeah.
Basically, there was a set of predefined figures that you had to skate into the ice, hence figure skating. According to two-time Olympic medalist turned commentator Dick Button, quote, 100 years ago, nobody knew about free skating. That part didn't exist. Figure skating, as in drawing figures, was an art form in itself. It was like penmanship to the hand. And I'll show you guys a video that I will add to the show notes.
That's so exciting. What a cool idea.
I'm very thrown by how little space this guy is taking up.
Yeah, these are tiny figures.
Yeah, when I picture...
That's a great point.
When I picture figure skating now, I picture people taking up the entire rink.
Like the camera's like racing to catch them.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't doubt that this is really technically difficult, but God, it looks boring.
Right.
Well, we're going to get to the most boring part, if you continue with the video, is not just the person skating, but then the judges having to judge it. You'll see them all huddled around it. There's like 7 people with clipboards.
There are loads of people standing on the ice in this video, just around the man, which is so weird.
Which is also very funny compared to modern. Yeah, they're all just hanging out, wearing regular clothes. It's like taking a test rather than a performance almost.
Yeah. Sorry, you said this ended in 1908.
That's when it first started.
Oh, it started then. Okay.
Absolutely intrigued by this. Were the figures anything in particular, or were they just shapes that
they
were made
predefined
for?
Shapes that you had to do. They were mostly like figure based on the figure eight. They're all and like with like little loops and stuff. And the thing to keep in mind is that when figure skating was first introduced in 1908, compulsory figures, that part of the event, initially accounted for 60% of someone's score.
Oh, damn.
So, as one blog put it, the figures section often, quote, decided the outcome of figure skating competitions even before a figure skater's blade touched the ice to perform their solo because of the immense weight this component carried. Another thing to note about compulsory figures is that, according to the Wall Street Journal, at championship competitions at least, figures events alone could take 8 hours to perform and judge.
That sounds really boring.
I will say another thing. For 1 year, they brought up, I think it was 1908, they brought an even more esoteric event called special figures, where you could basically make any intricate shapes you wanted. And it was apparently so strange and difficult that they abandoned it the next year.
Nice.
Like they just did it for one. But I read a really interesting passage from this book, Culture on Ice, by Ellen Kestenbaum. And she describes special figures as something that Caroline pointed out, which is it's a really interesting inversion of skating, because in order to make beautiful shapes on the ground, you had to make all these like ugly contortions of your body. And so it was like the ice rather than the skater was what was beautiful. I found that really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say a lot of people, I think, held your initial opinion, Ella. Over time, this odd part of figure skating fell away, and the weight of figures dropped from 60% to 40 to 30 to 20 until it was phased out entirely in 1988, which is the year of the clip that I showed you.
A part of me also just wonders, like, how do you get into that? Just like as a kid being like, you know what you're gonna do? You're gonna draw pretty figures on the floor. Yeah.
I mean, is there any weirder than doing spins? I will say there is, interestingly, in 2015, there has been a movement to try to revive compulsory figures. Maybe not, if not at the Olympics, then just in the popular.
In general,
In general, and there are people who still seem to love it, But there is another forgotten sport from 1908 that has definitely left the public interest for the better. What sport pairs better with figure skating than pistol dueling?
Yes!
Dueling!
I've heard of this!
With live rounds?
With wax bullets.
Okay, this makes more sense.
I do want to be really clear right off the bat that this sometimes gets spoken about incorrectly online. Pistol dueling was not an official Olympic event.
Okay.
It was actually something even better, in my opinion. So
the black market Olympics.
I mean...
No!
So, first of all, sport dueling was an idea around this time to use, like, armor and wax bullets to be able to have, quote-unquote, safe duels.
Yeah, sounds safe.
I put those quotes because apparently one newspaper in 1908 put it, quote, there was, quote, just enough risk in these duels to make them exciting.
Nice.
No.
That's what I love about the Olympics is the potential harm and death.
Yeah.
One of the inventors of the sport was Paul de Villers, who was, I'm not making this up, both a duelist and a doctor, which, if you ask me, seems like insider trading. that's like being a dentist and a candy maker, or I guess more accurately, a dentist and a boxer. At this time, there was a huge overlap between fencers and duelists because they were both sort of like dueling sports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so basically, when all the fencers were gathering for the 1908 Olympics, they had this idea to basically flash mob the fencing grounds. As the Royal Armouries Museum put it, quote, on the appointed day, July 13th, 1908, the duelists assembled at the fencing grounds that had been prepared for the Olympic fencing competition that would subsequently take place on the 24th. Then, in front of invited guests and excited press representatives, both national and international, including The Sketch and The Daily Express, they proceeded to demonstrate the sport of dueling by shooting each other.
Wow.
With wax bullets while wearing their long protective coats and wire masks.
And did anyone get hurt?
Not that I could tell.
Well, that's something.
Good.
Okay, then.
But what's wild to me is they were basically busking at the Olympics by shooting each other, which is fucking amazing. That aspect of it I love, that they were just like, what if we just showed up and did it?
But their campaigning clearly didn't work, so.
Well, Ella, there's part of it that did work. So another game that was part of another unofficial program at the Olympics that year was bicycle polo, which is exactly what you think. It's polo on bicycles. Again,
lovely.
Fucking cool.
Stunning. Yeah, of course.
And after these two events happened, the Olympic Committee was basically like, you know what? That was actually pretty rad. Why don't we make this an official thing? Not pistol dueling, but at the 1912 Olympics Games, they started...
Bicycle dueling.
Yes, that's what we...
That's what they took away from this.
No, polo dueling with just the hammers, and they were just smashing. Making sports is so easy.
Just mash a bunch of them together.
At the 1912 Olympic Games, they started the first of many official demonstration sports.
Oh.
Which are games that are not for medals, but are more to showcase a sport, oftentimes one that has regional ties to the host city. So, for example, you have things like korfball at the 1920 Games in Antwerp, Belgium, Australian rules football in the 1956 Melbourne Games, the martial art Budo at the 1964 Tokyo Games.
They're just like, look at what we can do.
That would be a nice thing to bring back to the the Olympics,
yeah.
Like demonstrate, obviously, if they're safe. Like, just showing sports off them, you know, that could be of interest to people to get more people involved.
They wanted to bring sumo wrestling to the 2022 Tokyo Games, but unfortunately, because of COVID stuff, it fell off the table. We're going to get to that in a second, some of the why we don't do them anymore. But during this prime time of demonstration sports, there were a few absolutely wild ones, including in 1936, when there was a demonstration sport for gliding. Do you guys want to guess what that... I know that's kind of a vague word, but do you know what that implies? Caroline's making an airplane arms.
No, like with a glider.
Like a glider.
Uh-huh. It was literally piloting an unpowered glider plane to do tricks. It was also called aeronautics.
This is like gliding's still like a huge hobby still. That kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Doing tricks with it sounds terrifying.
Uh-huh.
Terrifying.
Perhaps more terrifying was the St. Moritz Winter Games in Switzerland, where they had something called horse ski-horing, which is basically a horse pulling you along on skis. It looks astoundingly dangerous.
Nice.
Sounds like a bad idea.
Because not only do you have skis and horses, you have ice. It seemed... I will send you guys a photograph, though.
I would just say, for the horses, that doesn't sound very
doesn't
good.
Doesn't sound fun.
Doesn't sound great for anybody involved. Oh, gosh, that does look scary.
Dog sledding, that would be a sick sport.
It was a demonstration. Are you looking up a list of demonstration sports?
No.
That was one.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I wasn't going to include it, but that was one of the demonstration sports. But yeah, this is probably as close as we are going to get to bringing back chariot racing is this, because this looks so dangerous. But one thing I want to mention is that a lot of demonstration games also would go on to become official Olympic Games.
Oh, fun.
For example, in 1924, the Paris Games had a demonstration of a sport called volleyball.
Oh.
Once it was introduced as a demonstration in 1924, 40 years later, which is a wild amount of time, it would then be added as an official game in 1964.
Oh. I guess it makes sense. There has to be like a big enough community of people doing it for it to be. So having a demonstration is a great way to like drum up that interest.
Yeah, to start it to eventually. It's like an incubator.
Yeah.
The Paralympic game of goalball was a demonstration event in 1972. And then the next game, it became a medal sport.
Goalball?
It is basically a blindfolded handball. It's unlike any other sport because it has to be dead quiet and you have to like hear the ball bouncing.
Yeah, I've actually seen them watch this at the Paralympics. Oh, yeah. So I think it's really interesting.
It's wild.
Favorite Paralympics game? Murder Ball, which is wheelchair rugby.
Yeah.
It's literally my nickname, Murder Ball. It's brutal. It's amazing sport.
Oh, howdy.
It is.
Another point to note is that some of these demonstration sports would return in other years, and they would sometimes be played more often than real Olympic events that we just abandoned after 1 year. For example, there was only 1 year that the Olympics held the events of high jump and long jump.
What?
Sorry. Misread that. Horse high jump and horse long jump.
Again, why are we testing the horses here?
That is just testing how fast and high how long and far your horse can jump. I don't, that doesn't make sense.
Look at how cool my horse is. It can jump this far.
Happened for 1 year.
Wait, was there a pole and everything?
Uh-huh.
And how many horses broke their legs and got shot during that time? Because I bet it was a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wild. They would do like the backflip thing like you do. Humans do at the high jump too. They would do and land on the mat and just.
Horse sports don't make sense.
Horts. Spores. But another reason I feel okay including demonstration sports in this list is because the act of demonstration sports themselves was discontinued as of 1992.
I think that sounds like a shame, to be honest.
Yeah.
It was literally just one of those things that falls by the wayside because you're too busy with other quote-unquote more important things, you know, which I think is a shame. But there is one last official Olympic event that was discontinued that I would be remiss to not mention. Have either of you heard of the Olympic arts competitions?
No.
There were medals you could get for artistic competitions at the Olympics.
Aww.
Can you guess what artistic events they were?
Sculpting.
Embroidery.
Embroidery. That would be so good.
That would be so much fun.
They did exactly the arts you'd expect. It was podcasting, TikToks, which was split into the 15-second and then minute categories. And then in 2021, they added the 3-minute category. Also stand-up comedy. Ha, ha, ha. No, the events...
Caroline's done.
That one did damage. I could hear
Caroline's
that.
Caroline's done.
The events were architecture, music, literature, sculpture, and painting.
Literature?
What?
We'll get into that. There was short form and long form literature. They were usually under like 20,000 words, but they were...
So it's just who could write the fastest.
Under 20,000 words?
No. You would either...
Bring something you'd already done at home.
Yes. They would have to be either unpublished works.
Okay, that's an award ceremony then, isn't it?
Oh, Ella, you're going to find all the reasons to hate this. Don't worry, there's more. But the wild thing is, unlike a one-off demonstration sport, this happened for 40 years. From 1912 to 1952.
No! So did all of the sculptors... sculpt something beforehand and then bring it in and
my first thought and possibly yours is why haven't I heard of this and why haven't I heard any of these like pieces of art that apparently have won gold medals?
Because everyone who ever won one of these was so ashamed that they never talked about it.
Ella, I'm gonna pull up a direct quote to pull that up in a second, but according to Smithsonian Magazine, as of 2012, there has only ever been one book written about the arts medals at the Olympics.
Oh.
And they interviewed that author, Richard Stanton. And part of the reason is all the works had to be sport themed.
Oh my God. That's so funny. No.
Uh-huh.
No.
Ella's fully face in hands.
That's so funny.
Ashamed to open her hands and live in this world where we let that happen.
Do we have any photos of any of the pieces created?
I will say, you know, they're like watercolors of athletes. Where we get really, really bad is the literature, and I did pull up a quote for that.
Well, first of all, I'm sure that a lot of the art was very good, but it's kind of like being like the Olympics for the literature one, being the Olympics being like, write fan fiction for us.
Ella, you are dead on. That is exactly what it is like, and I can't wait to read you some. As Smithsonian put it, quote, to satisfy the sport-inspired requirement, many paintings and sculptures were dramatic depictions of wrestling or boxing matches. The majority of the architecture plans were for stadiums and arenas. Right? Remember, architecture.
I didn't.
That really narrows that, doesn't it?
No.
To be clear, for architecture, they were plans, not actual.
I'm so sorry, Tom. I cannot wait to tell people this.
Uh-huh.
This is great. This is so good.
Okay, I can't wait to, there's some more to share with y'all. So because of these requirements, you have gold medal literature works like History of the Olympic Games by Ferenc Mezo.
Okay, fine.
Sure, of course.
Pretty standard.
But there is an often derided Olympic poem that was written by the founder of the Olympics Committee.
They shouldn't be allowed to compete.
It was under a pseudonym. Still don't think they should.
No.
But this poem, in part, reads, quote, "Oh, sport, you are beauty. You, the architect of this house, the human body, which may become object of sublime according as to whether it is defiled by base passions or cherished with wholesome endeavor."
Oh, no.
I can't. I'm just like covering my mouth in shock.
Ella's. I'm so truly.
I'm horrified. This has like really changed the whole Olympics in my mind to like a place where I actually just think it's bad now.
I am going to become insufferable every 4 years when I bring this up when the Olympics is happening to everybody
I
know.
Oh my God.
It continues to get worse.
No.
As Smithsonian goes on to report, there were other troubles. They say, quote, "The format of the competitions was inconsistent and occasionally chaotic. A category might garner a silver medal, but no gold. Or the jury might be so disappointed in the submissions that it awarded no medals at all."
Oh, that's so hard.
Honestly, at least they had standards, like some standards.
I agree, but can you fucking imagine training for years and winning a marathon and the judges were like, not fast enough. I actually didn't like that one. Like, you beat everyone else, but...
No, I just can't. I'm sorry. I'm so overwhelmed.
This is so much.
They go on to say, quote, and this is, you might have gleaned this being true, but they say, quote, "The fact that the events had been initiated by art outsiders rather than artists, musicians, or writers, and the fact that all entries had to be sport themed also led many of the most prominent potential entrants to decide the competitions were not worth their time."
Yeah, fair enough.
The author Stanton said, "Artists, quote, didn't want to have to compete because it might damage their own reputations."
That's brutal.
Totally fair. And all that was left the year after the submissions was an 8-year-old's drawing of his... that's my dad on a bike.
Fast running man. Yeah. Big jump guy. But gets even better. That shade from artists to the Olympics was also thrown by the Olympics to the artists.
You're just not good enough to get our medals.
No, Ella?
No!
Listen, apparently one Olympic official complained, quote, "There are not enough artists who have connected with the world of sport," which translates to, "You're all a bunch of fucking nerds. You don't understand anything, any of these sports."
You don't get it. You're not one of us.
Wow. Yeah.
I think I don't want to shit on anyone's creative work, obviously. And I'm sure there were some genuinely good works that should not be forgotten. And if anyone can find them, please share them with us.
Because Tom couldn't.
We didn't find them.
But I'm more so curious also, if you find any embarrassingly bad ones, also share them with
us.
Yeah,
nice.
We would like
on our Discord server, letsleareverythingpod.com.
But it seems like there's a reason people forgot that this happened. And what I found interesting as I was doing all this research is that, you know, as one of those artists with no connection to the world of sport myself, I went into this research thinking I was going to talk mostly about the arts when I first came up with this topic, but I had so much more fun researching forgotten sports like tandem bicycling.
Oh,
and
love it.
Dartery, which is playing darts with bows and arrows.
Oh my God, I love that.
So many others I didn't have time to include. Again, if you have a favorite, share it in the Discord. And, you know, it took me a second to realize, like, why this was. But I think the reason is because, first of all, I don't really care about the institution of the Olympics or, like, the Olympic Committee. I think, frankly, they've done a lot of bad shit that could fill a whole topic of its own. And part of me loves that this exalted institution is full of mistakes. I find that really humbling.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I love about dueling and special figures and Corey Bose's 30-second race and especially demonstration sports is they're all so awkward and strange, but they're all clearly really earnestly trying something. And there's something there that's more human and more poetic than any of the sports-themed poems written at the Olympics.
I think, to your last point, Tom, which is excellent, one of the things that I have really enjoyed about this topic is how humans can turn anything into a sport if they try.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a great point.
It's such like a fundamentally human thing to want to be like, okay, guns at each other, how do we make that a sport? It's so weird. All of it's so weird. And I'm like, humans, it's like, it is inherently creative how we can do to these things into like things that are fun and satisfying for us.
Couldn't have put it better myself, Ella.
It's Review Corner. This is my favorite song. It's Review Corner.
Stunning.
Stunning.
10 out of 10.
Today's five-star review comes from us, and it's for the Max Fun Network.
Nice.
This is our first year, like we said. They have been the most welcoming group of folks willing to take in a bunch of fucking rascals like us, some fucking goblins, so early on. And, you know, behind the scenes, everyone there has been so kind and transparent, and they all really care about the shows. So I would say 5 out of 5, 5 stars. Can't recommend enough being part of the network. And you can join us as being part of the network at MaximumFun.org/join. Get some cool pledge rewards, bonus content. And I like to think of our bonus episodes as our demonstration sports. It's our space to try weird formats and stuff like that.
Nice.
Any plugs and shout out?
Yes. Don't forget to join our live stream on the 27th of March at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All the links are in the show notes and at letslearneverythingpod.com. So, to wrap this all up, today we have learnt that large language models can be a help or a hindrance in science, depending on how you approach it. We have learnt that the smell of space is rich with kind of fruity undertones.
Stinky with fruity undertones. Acrid with fruity.
It's more complex than you would realize depending on where you are.
Very generous term.
Or smells of nothing at all.
Or more likely smells of nothing at all. And we have learned that although the arts are the most ridiculous things to not be in Olympic Games anymore, there are so many wonderful human things that we have done over the years with the Olympic Games, and I hope some of them come back one day.
Yeah.
Please join us next time where we will learn everything. Let's Learn Everything is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted and produced by Ella Hubber, Tom Lum, and Caroline Roper, with editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum. There's a scene in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia where Charlie says that he's, who my cat is named after, was burning. He's been burning.
No. Pause.
My cat Charlie is named after Charlie Day or Charlie Kelly from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
We did not know that. What?
No. How has this never come up? I'm sorry. We can continue.
Anyway.
That's great.
He's been burning all the garbage in the bar. Because that's the green option, because it gets, you know, breaks down into stuff that goes into the stars. And the rest of the characters are like, I don't think that's right, but I don't know enough about science to dispute it. But now I'm kind of thinking, was he wrong?
Maybe.
Please don't burn your garbage.
Please do not do that. Thank you.
Especially if you're driving.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.